You're listening to the Illustration Hour podcast, an interview podcast where I talk to illustrators, art directors, and agents about the craft and business of illustration. My name is Julia Dufossé, and I'm an editorial and commercial illustrator based in Chicago. And I'm chatting with creatives within the world of illustration to learn about their process, the challenges they faced along the way, and how to succeed as an illustrator today.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another week of the Illustration Hour. We have a very exciting episode planned for today. My guest today is Jing Wei. She is a Chinese-born and California-raised illustrator. Jing moved to the United States when she was about 7 years old with her parents. She moved from China and found herself in a country where she didn't speak the language and also didn't understand the culture. Now, many years later, Jing is a very successful illustrator. She has done work for clients like Adobe, Airbnb, Bloomberg, BuzzFeed, Google, Headspace, The New York Times, The New Yorker, NPR, Panda Express, Pinterest, the list goes on. Jing studied at RISD. She studied illustration, and then she went on to work at Etsy as one of the brand designers there. I talked to Jin about how she got started in illustration, some of the hurdles she faced in the very beginning, how she established herself, and how she defined her voice and style. We also talk about her time at Etsy and how it impacted the way her illustration looks today. It was such a wonderful conversation. I've been a huge fan of Jing since pretty much the beginning of my illustration career. I think her work is fantastic, and I love the message behind her work. I really think it has a very particular atmosphere to it, and I really like it. You can find the comprehensive show notes for this episode at illustrationhour.com/Wei. That's W-E-I. And you can also go to that directly from the show notes below the episode. You can find Jing's work on her website, which is jingweistudio.com, or on Instagram. She's at Jing, not Jane. At Jing, not Jane. Her work is fantastic. And of course, I will put all of that in the show notes for this episode as well. I hope you enjoy my conversation with the very talented Jing Wei. So hello, Jing. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Julia. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really, really happy to talk with you. And honestly, when I wrote you an email like a couple months back, I really expected to never hear back. You were one of my like dream interviews.
Oh my goodness, because that's so sweet of you. It actually took me a really long time to get back to you, and I'm very sorry about that.
No, but that's fine. Yeah. because I don't know, because you're quite famous in America. Your work I saw a lot when I was starting out, and I really admired it. And I don't know, you seem to always speak about it too, which I really liked. Like, I felt like you really had a voice in the industry. And
wow.
So you were a big inspiration in the beginning, especially.
That's amazing to hear. Thank you. Kind of just like do your thing, and it's. I don't know how I'm perceived, or I try not to think about it. But that's really flattering and awesome to hear.
Yeah, I mean, you're quite public. I mean, in the illustration world, I guess, relatively speaking.
Do you ever feel like that or no? I'm very self-deprecating in general. Yeah. So I just think that
I kind of got that from you already. But like, I can see that you're not like arrogant or like
out of touch with reality or anything.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I think it's a balance, right? Like, you need a healthy dose of ego to do this freelance thing. But then at the same time, it's also good to remind yourself that we're in such an illustration bubble. And what is famous within the illustration context anyway? I'm very happy to have gotten to be where I am now. And
yeah,
I feel very honored to inspire other people with my work. So I guess, yeah, I wouldn't disagree with what you're saying, but I also would never qualify myself as like a famous person, you know, or a famous illustrator.
Yeah. So let's start with, like, when you're at a party or something and someone asks you what you do and they don't know anything about your work, what do you usually say?
I just straight up say that I'm an illustrator. And then I expect some questions after that, and then I try to answer those to the best of my ability.
Yeah. Are people usually surprised that you can make a living out of illustration?
Yeah, I think it depends on who I'm talking to. I actually really enjoy the people who are much more straightforward, because I think people generally have an idea of a lot of people who are not in the creative field don't really know what illustration means. And so they either lump it with design or with something that they're more familiar with, like children's books or cartoons or comics. So I think the second step is usually trying to describe exactly what it is that I do, because it is very specific in terms of all of the occupations out there.
Yeah. So most of your work comes from commercial clients or editorial? It's a little bit of a mix, right? You have both.
Yeah, it's definitely a mix. At this point, it's mostly commercial, which is something that I'm grappling with, because I feel like up until now, it's sort of been a way to make a living. And I do really enjoy the work that I am making and where I've taken it. But then I feel like as you get older and as you get deeper into your career, you almost start to crave something more than just like that daily grind and, jumping from client to client. So
yeah,
that's definitely like a more of a long-term thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you have to
So I want to go back to the beginning, and you were born in China. You spend the first 7 years of your life there, and then your parents moved to California when you were about 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then you ended up moving there, and I think you didn't even speak English really when you moved, right?
No, not at all. I think I knew like three phrases, and I always used them in the wrong context. So I definitely did not know any proper English.
So did you actually, were you put into an American school? And like,
I was, yes. Yeah. I moved to the Bay Area, and there was a fair amount of diversity where I was, which I think was really great. And I'm glad that I had that experience. I went through the public school system, and I had a really great experience overall. I definitely was enrolled in, you know, classes that helped me learn English. And outside of that, it was pretty much just a normal elementary school through middle school through high school experience.
Yeah. So did you feel like you fit in quite quickly, or was it really rough at the beginning?
It's definitely rough at the beginning, but it's rough, I think, just in general for that age. You're just kind of figuring out how to be a person and how to live in the world. Actually, I would say that at the age of 7, you're not quite as self-conscious yet.
But you absorb things very quickly too.
Exactly. Yeah. And your friendships are sort of based on, you know, very superficial things, but also very sweet and innocent things.
Yeah.
And I think that now looking back, being an immigrant and being someone who is sort of on the outside, perhaps instilled a little bit of insecurity in me at an early age. And there was always this sense of needing to fit in and needing to acclimate and sort of shed my Chinese identity so that I could not appear as a weirdo or, you know, an alien in my immediate environment. So some of that, I think, unfortunately, was a bit unavoidable. And I was very young, and I had a pretty positive experience with friends and growing up in California. But there was definitely a bit of that insecurity and a bit of that awareness of my identity and how I fit in with everyone else.
Yeah. So in school, you were already quite passionate about art and drawing, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And you eventually decided to pursue art school after you graduated high school. Sorry, and you ended up going to RISD.
I did.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I pretty much made that decision. I guess it wasn't a spur of the moment decision, but in high school, when it came time to apply to colleges, I sort of, you know, evaluated my life and my passion, and I pretty much didn't see myself being interested in anything long term outside of, you know, a creative pursuit. So this is where I feel very lucky in that my parents were 100% on board with me making that decision and going down that very specific path, because it could have easily backfired and, you know, all their worst fears could come true and I could be living at home, not using my degree, basically. But I basically applied to 5 art schools, and then I got into RISD, and I think that was the one
dream school?
Or? I wouldn't say, I don't even think I had a dream school. I think that they had a dream school and it was RISD.
Your parents?
Yeah, because they, you know, they do the research and RISD sort of places atop of the list most years.
I mean, RISD is a great school, yeah.
Yeah, it was I had a really good experience there. But, you know, also for Chinese parents, and I guess parents in general, you know, they want the ideally for their child to go to a school with some sort of acclaim. I think that in particular was very important for my parents. So that was a compromise. Like if I was trying to pursue this illustration career, I had to do it at one of the best schools and, you know, be amongst the quote unquote best, most hardworking students. And then my father and I, did sort of a college tour and went around to different campuses. And that's when I fell in love with RISD. I stepped foot on the campus and I walked around Providence and I was like, oh, this is where I want to spend 4 years.
Kind of a strange place because you have Brown right there and it's sort of like a weird little place.
It felt like a very college town.
It is.
And I'm really in awe of kids who go to New York or like, you know, a much larger city for schools. I feel like I would have died or nothing would have worked out.
It was kind of really distracting.
And super intimidating too. Maybe you grow up a bit faster and you learn those life skills, which is also awesome, but
I don't know. Yeah, it depends which school you go to, probably.
Perhaps. Yeah. I felt like we were in a bit of a bubble, just, you know, working really hard and having enough to do, but not so many distractions that we weren't in studio every night.
Yeah. And so when you went, did you already talk about yourself like you were going to do illustration, or did you say like you were going to do design? Or because especially with your parents and stuff, like explaining what you were going to do, what did you say your plans were really when you left?
Well, I think that I had no plan. I knew that I was good at drawing, and I knew that that was the skill that I could hold on to and that I could.
And that was enough for them. Really?
That was enough for, they really had a lot of faith in me, or if they didn't, they hit it pretty well. So, so I guess that was, I never even thought about another major. I was not interested in design. I wasn't interested in fine art. I think, or painting, and illustration seemed to be this very, open, major that could, it sort of felt like I was making a decision, but I also wasn't making a decision at the same time, because illustration was just this giant umbrella and I could use drawing as a starting point and then eventually figure out how to make a living out of that skill.
Did your parents have a reference point for like illustration or illustrators that had made it or something that they really saw it in this way?
Because
I think your dad's like dye chemist, and your mom's an engineer or something like that, right?
Yes. Wow. Great research. Yeah, they are. There's actually no one in my entire family that we know of has pursued any sort of creative career.
Yeah.
So I think I'm the first and currently only one. They didn't really have a point of reference. And I think that to this day, I still kind of have to explain to them remind them what it is that I do and explain, you know, obviously they don't know the ins and outs of the illustration industry. So I'm still like, telling them that sometimes I'll tell them about a project and they're like amazed that that can be a project for me. Like that's something
like,
that people do
for
money. Yeah, exactly. Like when I first told them that I was starting to do murals, they thought that I was like going to paint people's houses. I think they were like, oh wow. Okay. You know, you don't have to do that. But no point of reference.
I'm sure it helps that you were successful in they can see that now.
Yeah, over time. I mean, I've been doing this for, I've been out of school for over 10 years. So
yeah.
It's taken a while to build up that success. And you know, it ebbs and flows. I think they were really happy when I got a part-time job at Etsy, because that was like really steady footing. And then since yeah. then, that was like, yeah. you know, a nice springboard for me. And after that, I really gained a lot more confidence in my career. But yeah, in terms of going to RISD, I kind of was just, I wanted to go and focus on drawing and then see how I could develop that further. And I really started with mostly technical skills. Like I had really no ability to conceptualize an image. So I think it was all like still life drawing. You know, I was taking private art lessons when I was young, and it pretty much just all stemmed from there.
So you didn't have a recognizable style or anything that looks like your style now?
No,
you have a very distinct style now. So.
No, not at all. I think, you know, if you saw like my high school work and my early college work, it very much looks like sort of like a textbook art student work. You know, there wasn't really much personality.
Well, that's how most people start too. I mean, you start with the technical and some people start with a very distinct style. Like I saw the notebooks of Tomi Ongerer, and it looks it looks like he's drawing exactly like how he draws now, which is really weird.
That's kind of
like
amazing.
As a child, he made these like really amazing illustrations. Like, yeah. I don't know. But
that's
yeah,
so cool.
I mean, for most people, I feel like your stuff really evolves.
I know.
And that's probably good.
Yeah, it has to go through a very ugly phase. And I mean, when I hear about someone like that, I get envious, because I think I romanticize that situation, you know, like, oh, you've always drawn this way. You can't help but be this very unique person with this very unique voice. But the reality for me was that it took me a really long time to find anything that I was happy with, that worked, you know, that clients wanted to use, just all of those.
Did that happen while at RISD, or did it happen later?
It took a while for me, actually. I think that I did start to get illustration jobs, like editorial jobs, because it's actually a really easy way to ease into the industry. I think there's always a ton of editorial work if you're available and you're able to have a somewhat put together a somewhat pleasant image with a simple concept. I think that you will be able to get some work somewhere, especially if you promote yourself, you know? And I think that's where I was starting out. I was just sending out so many postcards and you know, just basically.
While you were in school?
Yeah. Right after I graduated, actually. Yeah. I got my first job while I was in school because of a teacher of mine. And you've probably heard his name come up. His name is Chris Bozzelli, and his wife, Su Jin, she art directs a suite of financial magazines. And they are sort of like this power couple in the way that they like really help a lot of young students find their style, find their voice. And they also, like, to be honest, they financially support these young students as well, because Su Jin is very open to hiring new talent. And, you know, sort of guiding them through that ugly period of their work.
So that was your first assignment? Was that the first editorial assignment?
I mean, that was my first editorial assignment, coming out of school. And that sort of gave me a little bit of money to help move to New York, because she gave me a cover, and that was really amazing. And I think I've only gotten like two or three covers from her since. So that was like a very big job for me at the time.
Yeah, cover assignment is really, it's really nice. And especially for a first assignment, it's like, it's pretty, it must have boosted your confidence too.
Yeah, I think that was maybe even more valuable than the money itself, that it sort of made me feel like, oh, I can do this. I can perhaps do this. So I think it was that, and also moving with friends, that just sort of kept my endurance up. I think that it's really, in the beginning, it's really easy to become discouraged, and you just want that recognition. You want that success right away. But in all honesty, it just really takes a very long time. So
you graduated in 2008, I think,
yes.
Which is kind of
awful. A horrible year to graduate.
Yeah, it's the worst year to graduate. And like right when the whole housing and mortgage crisis happened.
Yeah.
And then you moved to New York, which must have been scary too.
Super scary.
Yeah. with some friends, and you tried to freelance, right?
Yes.
Right away.
Yeah, I moved with some friends. I mean, I actually, in retrospect, romanticized that year because we were all so poor but we were such good friends, and there was such a like nice post-college community. It felt like college 2.0, you know, so it didn't feel quite as scary because of these people and because of, you know, the community that we created for ourselves.
Did you find jobs at that time, or was it really rough to find assignments?
I found some jobs, but it was so spotty. Like, you never knew when something was going to come in, and I would bend over backwards for any job that came in because I didn't know when I was going to get the next one. I definitely found a steady side job during those first couple of years. I had a part-time job teaching Mandarin to babies on the Upper West Side, rich babies.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was really interesting because it really had nothing to do with what I was trying to do as a career. But actually, it was also kind of a nice break. It just felt so surreal every time I was in that space. But I chalked it up.
How young were the babies you were teaching?
They were 2 years old.
Yeah, that seems too young.
Like, wait, with rolling around
with no Chinese parents, just learning Mandarin, or
for the most part, at least one of the parents was Chinese, but
most
of the parents did not speak Chinese. So I think that they wanted to. It sort of skips a generation. They want their kids to, you know, be able to communicate with their grandparents and grow up bilingual, at least bilingual.
Yeah.
So
That's cool. And it teaching a language to a kid that young is probably weird.
I know. I was like, what am I doing here? Are you retaining any of this?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was fun. It was fun for me.
Yeah. So you kept going, and I imagine it must have been really hard to like make a living off of just the illustration then, because you were doing that part time. And
yeah. I definitely didn't. I wasn't sure if it was possible for a little while. And I think that in the first few years, every time that I thought that this was not possible, like a new job would come in or a new opportunity would come in. You know, it was always like when I was at the height of all of my doubts and insecurities, that there would be something to keep me going.
Was it strictly editorial at the time, or?
At the time, it definitely was strictly editorial, or it was mostly editorial. There were a few weird jobs that I don't even know how I would categorize, you know, like a random illustration for a company t-shirt for a company that you've never heard of, or just something for a friend's friend. So stuff like that.
And was your style already at a place where you were really happy with it, or were you still struggling to kind of find what you wanted to do?
I wasn't unhappy with it, but I definitely always thought that it was a work in progress. And, you know, going back to the self-deprecating thing, I think that's something that's almost like a tool that I use, and a very unhealthy tool that I use to sort of keep going, you know, to propel myself forward.
Well, as long as it doesn't discourage you, I guess, if it keeps you.
No, it's just
trying.
The right amount.
Yeah, yeah. Because you could go too far and then you're just depressed.
Oh, yeah. I know. Yeah. And I've seen, then that's just bad. I've seen friends who have a similar thing, and then they end up feeling discouraged and sort of giving into that. That self-deprecation and thinking that maybe they actually can't do it. And that's been really disappointing because, you know, when you're in art school, everyone is sort of in the same place, and then you get out and you see that a lot of people, more often than not, don't end up pursuing what it is that they set out to do. And if they end up finding something else that they love, then obviously that pivot is great. But sometimes I feel like it can be out of a lack of confidence or a lack of trying. I was definitely trying to avoid that. And I was very lucky.
To avoid like being discouraged and just giving up, or?
Yeah, just moving out of New York. And I mean, it definitely was very hard and upsetting and at times depressing. But I think I just always wanted to stick it out and hope for the best.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then you ended up doing some work for Etsy freelance, right?
Yeah. So I think that was pretty much when I started gaining the confidence that this could be a viable career. Because I had a steady client in Etsy. I started freelancing for them. Basically they gave me a call and they told me that they were testing out a few illustrators. because yeah. they wanted to start an illustration presence in the company. And mm-hmm. They had just started forming their brand design team. So I was talking to the creative director at the time, Randy Hunt, and we created three spot illustrations, and then heard back very shortly thereafter that I was the person that they wanted to move forward with. And at the time, I had no idea what that meant. Like, I could not yeah. have predicted that it would turn into this crazy thing that's, you know, been a huge,
like,
impactful.
You thought you would get a few commissions
and, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then it just, they kept commissioning me, and I was basically on like a freelance retainer situation for about a year after that.
Yeah.
And then I started to, because I signed the contracts that I signed, stated that the company couldn't use the work for past, I want to say 3 months or so. And then I noticed that they're still using the work on their website. So I brought it up and I was like, hey, you know, you need to either pay me more if you're going to continue to use the work, or we need to figure out a different situation here, or maybe renegotiate the contract. And so that's the conversation that spurred this steady part-time salaried situation.
Wow. So you actually like confronted them about,
Yeah,
that's interesting. Because I would be so scared to do that, especially when they're a regular client and you're getting good money from them. But at the same time, like,
I was scared, but I actually I had a friend at the company, and actually everyone at the company, they were all so nice that I just trusted them as people. I think it's rare that you get to that point with a client, you know, just as a freelancer, but because we had been working together and developing these relationships for so long, I trusted that they wouldn't just like cut me off, that they would at least be open to having a conversation about my concerns.
Yeah.
Because at this point, you know, I'd sort of built up, a trust with them, a mutual trust with them.
Yeah. And so what did they do in response then?
They actually took pretty quick action, and I got on the phone with Randy, the creative director, and we just we talked about what I would need from like a more permanent position. And I told him that I needed it to be part time so that I could still do my freelance. And then the trade off is that, you know, the company then owns all of the work, and then I would get all of the benefits of a regular employee. So we worked that out, and then everything kind of changed after that. I became an official member of the brand design team. So all of a sudden I was sort of on the other side, and I was more on the company side.
Well, that's really interesting, because I mean, you don't see a lot of steady jobs like that for illustrators. I mean, you do see a couple mm-hmm. once in a while, like especially in Silicon Valley now, there's more like, I don't know, I saw Lyft is hiring a brand illustrator recently.
Yeah.
It's kind of rare to have that kind of steady job. And I guess the trade-off is also that you can't really necessarily illustrate in your style. You have to mm-hmm. conform to their brand guidelines and what they want to do.
I think that's definitely changed a lot. Well, when I first signed up for this job, this was maybe, I want to say it was 2014, end of 2013.
Yeah, not that long ago. Yeah.
But even then, I couldn't think of another person who had a similar position.
Because your title was brand illustrator,
it was brand illustrator, and then eventually it moved to being illustration director because I started art directing a bit as well.
Yeah.
In the beginning it was just brand illustrator, and I didn't really know how to negotiate the contract. I didn't know how much I should be paid. I just like remember not really having many people to turn to sort of help to discuss this, because I love having a community around me and I love talking about pricing with my friends, and this was a situation where nobody really knew you know how to handle it or what the norm was.
Yeah.
So I think I was able to negotiate a pretty good situation, but now I think there are a lot of examples of positions like this.
Yeah.
I mean, more than before, at least.
Yeah. It's still not the most common.
No, it's still rare. Yeah.
To get jobs. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. And people do, you know, it's kind of like a rare unicorn, I guess. But I think that when I first graduated, this wasn't even like a conceivable thing. So now it's cool that it is possible for a company to hire a person for their illustration skills, like they would hire an engineer, you know, or like an HR person. So.
Or design even, because they do hire designers.
Yeah, yeah, sometimes. Definitely. Yes.
Yeah.
Or design. Yeah. I think that that kind of goes to show the hierarchy of what companies value. And illustration.
Well, they maybe don't think that they need one at all times.
Or yes, exactly. Like, yeah. And when they do, they'll freelance or outsource it. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. And so were they very strict with you about the style that you had to illustrate with, like you had to keep to a certain style or colors, or I imagine that there were guidelines for how you illustrated, right?
Yeah. Weirdly, no, in the beginning, because nobody really knew. We didn't know what we were doing.
Also because they just started. So yeah. You kind of got to define, I guess.
We just started and we all met, like the whole team met, went on a retreat, and we talked about what the brand was going to be. And I joined like kind of right when that happened. And I don't even remember what came out of those meetings. I think we started with, okay, it's going to be orange. and I was like, cool.
Did they not branding. Have the orange yet?
They did have the orange.
Oh.
So we were just starting slow, you know? I think that was pretty much the only guideline. I started, we tried to force this thing that ultimately didn't work. We tried to only illustrate an orange line for a while, but then there were so many situations that demanded full color and shape illustrations that it kind of just ended up being a limited palette, but nothing really outside of that, you know?
You were illustrating people kind of like how you illustrate people now, right?
Yeah.
And illustrating same types of shapes and the same types of worlds around.
I mean, weirdly, go ahead.
You got to kind of do that without them kind of like making you do anything else, really, right?
Yeah, and I guess that's sort of a double-edged sword, because I think that I kind of developed my style at Etsy because I was making so much work. And I started to not be so precious with it, which I think was something that, like, that mentality sort of unlocked something in my style, because I was able to just make a piece, move on, make another piece, move on, and then slowly make these tweaks and adjustments and improvements along the way until I came out with a body of work that I wanted to develop further. But so the other side, and that's great that they gave me resources to do that. But the other side of that is that sometimes I wasn't sure where the separation was between the company style and my style. And to be honest, there really was no separation, which I think became sort of problematic.
You could start like feeling a little bit like a fraud, I guess. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wasn't sure if that was like cheapening my own work. I was questioning what my own work even was at that point.
And you were still kind of at the beginning too of your career. So
yeah, definitely.
Super scary to.
Yes, because I felt like, oh, well, I really need to. I was on high alert, I would say, most of the time.
Yeah.
Because despite how nice everyone was, I really loved all of the people that I've worked with there. But I was always like just ready to be screwed, you know? Yeah. Like I just didn't want to be fucked over, because in the end it's still a giant tech company. So I just always had that in the back of my mind.
Yeah. Although you don't frequently hear stories about Etsy as much as the other kind of like big tech companies.
No.
I don't think I've heard that much about them. That's like, yeah.
No, I mean, this is a company that supports small businesses and individual artists. So that was a good place to start, you know?
Yeah, and they still use a lot of the branding that you must have worked on.
Yeah, I think they do. It's been a couple of years now. I think that they made a concerted effort to stop, actually, because based on things that I've heard from people who still work there. So I think that they've basically just stripped a lot of the branding after the layoffs that happened a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay.
And they restructured everything. So now I think that there isn't as much of an illustration presence, but maybe there's like, you know,
it does look like when you were there, I mean, they were doing a lot more stuff in illustration and Yeah. And that was kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, it was really cool for me, too, because, I mean, actually, a lot of my favorite projects were internal because they just allowed me to work at these crazy scales. And I, at that point in my career, I couldn't have gotten those kinds of projects on my own.
Yeah, because you had like this crazy like mural at, mm-hmm. at the HQ, right?
Or Yeah. And it's still there. So people That's cool. still get to like walk by and take pictures with it, which is really awesome.
Was that your first mural or...
No, my first one was actually in the San Francisco office. So I think a lot of what was great about that job is that I, you know, there was definitely kind of like a fake it till you make it mentality where I was going to be flown out to San Francisco to paint a mural, which is something that I've never done before. And they just trusted me and put all this money into this project. And I told them what I needed.
Did you say you had painted a mural before?
No. Yeah. Oh, actually, no, that's not true. The first mural
You were just kind of vague. You were like, yeah.
I was like, I can do this. Like, I'll get it done. actually, the first mural I painted was actually in the New York office. I forgot about that one because it was such a traumatic experience that I totally blocked it out of my memory. It took like 3 weeks, which is not normal for a mural project.
Murals are actually really hard.
They are really hard.
Yeah,
and they often underpay, which is horrible.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that we can get into that later, but... Obviously, this was not a paid.
Well, that kind of makes sense to me because people kind of maybe devalue them in a way because they think it's so like temporary or I don't know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I don't know what the mentality behind it is because it's so much physical labor, so much more physical labor than any other type of commercial job. It really shouldn't be that way. But yes, the first mural that I did was a complete experiment and it was really difficult. And I think that I just didn't, I listened to a lot of input from my upper management and I shouldn't have done that. So that was a lesson learned. And that actually made me realize that I actually did have the ability to lead these projects and I should just go with my gut and just trust myself to do this. So I did that for the San Francisco one and it was so much more successful.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Really being a problem also because sometimes they don't really have an idea of the design that or the illustration kind of side of it things so they wouldn't necessarily understand what's going on exactly or I don't know
or the processes. I mean I was really the only illustration person there, so I think that in their words they looked to me as an authority on illustration and I didn't really know how to handle that in the beginning, and then I sort of just got more comfortable in that role over time.
So that's often like advice that you give people is to like kind of like try to just fake it basically.
Well, there's no point in sabotaging yourself, so why not just try it and give it your best shot and then see how it turns out. You can always
But if without sabotaging yourself you could be kind of like I guess you could be asking a lot of questions and being like I want to make sure I'm doing this right, and that might not be the best way to go about it.
I guess that I think that it is important to have support and to have more information. I was definitely asking my studio mates a lot of questions. Yeah. So I think I was learning a lot from them because I see them as peers and then my coworkers and, you know, my art directors and creative directors, I think were more just, you know, they were more my coworkers and not my peers. So so I think it is definitely important to ask for help. I don't think that makes you look weak or vulnerable in any way.
But when it's the people who are paying you and you're expecting to get jobs and
make
a good impression, it can be hard to.
I wouldn't. Yes, absolutely. You have to exude a sense of professionalism. I would not ask my clients how to do my job. But I would definitely ask my friends. And I guess I think that's really important.
Yeah. So then what happened that made you eventually leave Etsy?
It's been
a couple of years, right?
Yeah, I was there for it's been a couple of years. I think I was there, I was at my salaried position for about 3.5 years.
Wow, yeah, okay.
And I got laid off. It was crazy.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, this was I wanted the office, the in-house office job experience, and being laid off is one of those experiences sometimes. So I felt like I really got the whole thing.
Well, that's interesting also because people always tell you how it's just not not very stable to be a freelancer.
I know.
You did the right thing and you were like laid off.
Yeah. I know. It still didn't work out. I think it was actually the perfect outcome for me. This was like in the middle of 2017. And at the beginning of 2017, I had my last project that I was excited about at Etsy. And I kind of knew it. I was like, this is the last mural that I'm doing for a little while. I think this is the last one that I'm going to be excited for. And then the rest is just sort of like day-to-day stuff. And then they started needing less illustration. I was also feeling really antsy. I kind of felt like it was time to move on, but I also felt the golden handcuff situation where it's such a cushy job that I didn't really know how to make that jump.
You were still doing jobs on the side?
Like I was.
Editorial?
Yeah. And I think, and this goes back to the whole like being on high alert all the time. I never wanted to lose my freelance clients just in case something like this happened or just in case this didn't work out. You know, I can't imagine. It would totally be like diving into the deep end.
So you think you would have stayed if they hadn't laid you off?
I think I would have stayed for a little while, but I think I probably would have quit by the end of the year. It kind of felt like it was time, and I was starting to get bigger jobs, and I was starting to have to turn down jobs because of my Etsy commitment. So at some point, it started to become not quite as worth it. And you could also feel the company culture start to shift. So everything sort of pointed to this direction. And it was definitely a harsh goodbye, but I think that it was also very necessary. But yeah, it happened in two waves, and I got laid off in the second wave along with a lot of my other coworkers. I think they just kind of dissolved the brand team completely and, like I said, sort of stripped the company down to like a very small, bare bones. Yeah.
Yeah.
They sort of like restarted it a bit.
Yeah, I didn't really know that about Etsy.
Yeah, I think that these, you know, the tech news sort of come and go. Like BuzzFeed had those crazy layoffs, Vice, you sort of hear about them. You hear about like a blip here and there, and then people just move on, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that happened a couple of years ago. And it was a really good learning experience because I was on the inside of it and I could kind of see like all of the mistakes that the company made to lead up to that crazy blow up. Yeah.
Do you think a lot of the connections you might have made around that time when you were working there, did that help you when you went back to freelance work afterwards? Or
oh, interesting.
Not so much?
I think that I definitely really got into the company culture, even despite only going to the office a couple of days a week. I really was super appreciative of my coworkers there because I think that they were the ones who really kept this this in-house tech job fun and warm and human. And I'm still really good friends with a lot of the people that I worked with there. Yeah. So I wouldn't say that
a tech company in Silicon Valley isn't the worst place to work when it comes to an office, you know?
Oh, that's absolutely true. Yeah. Yeah.
I can think of more like soul crushing stuff. Yeah,
definitely. Yes. I mean that I actually wonder how it would be if I lived in Silicon Valley. I probably would have had to dive even more into that culture. I think being in New York, it was sort of like the framework of a Silicon Valley tech company, but then filled with like misfits, like New York misfits, you know?
Yeah.
So I was really appreciative of that. Professionally, I actually run into like some of the clients that I work with now, like Skillshare or Google, I run into ex-Etsy people all the time. So it sort of feels like, you know, there's like this family that sort of permeates New York in a very nice way. It's always nice to see a friendly face. And I've made some of my closest friendships from that role. So that was really awesome.
So right after you left Etsy, you said it really started to pick up, but do you have a sense of why that is or why people, why you suddenly started to be able to make a living off of it, basically?
I think it's 100% the fact that I had stronger projects in my portfolio. I think that a lot of those mural jobs, the branding jobs, the icon work, like even a lot of the banners that I did and the in-person displays, a lot of like apparel, tote bag, just packaging design. It really like all of the work just spans so many categories that all of a sudden when I left, I had all of these examples of things could do. Yeah. So prior to that, I really had just a super editorial heavy portfolio. And if I hadn't had the Etsy job, I would probably only be getting editorial work.
I mean, it is possible to move from editorial to commercial. I see some illustrators doing that, but yeah, like it definitely feels like for you it really picked up. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, editorial is just it's very easy to use that as a jumping off point. And I still do a lot of editorial work. I think it's definitely something that's part of the foundation of my work in general. But maybe having the Etsy role jumpstarted a bunch of other things.
Did a company start reaching out to you when you were basically after you were laid off, or did you have to do a lot of like reaching out to people? And
I actually don't think I promoted myself after getting laid off. I think I took a very small break. But I had already had a couple of jobs lined up when the layoff happened. I mean, there was no warning for the layoff. All of us, it just happened very suddenly. I think I had like a few days, where I was trying to figure out if it was going to happen. And then all of a sudden I was full-time freelance. I think that I thankfully just, was lucky enough that people started reaching out to me because I posted that I was full-time and somehow that like sent vibes out into the universe. So
did you already have a really big social media audience? Cause you do have quite a bit now, but.
I think I was starting to build, a stronger, I think right around that time I was starting to pivot to just being an illustration only Instagram. And I think that focusing more on that definitely helped as well. I was going to say something, but I totally forgot.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's okay. It's just ever since we turned off our air conditioning for this podcast, I've just been like slowly heating up. So now,
yeah, me too. I'm heating up too.
Starting to get a little delirious.
Yeah, yeah. But so what was one of the? Do you remember the first big client you got, like after you left Etsy? Or
I think I was working on a Google job. The day that I got laid off, I can't believe I forgot about this. The day I got laid off, basically they corralled us all into a tiny room and then gave us instructions for how to leave the company. And then we turned in our laptops. And I had like maybe half an hour, 45 minutes to get out of there. And then as soon as I left that room, I had to take a call with Google like 15 minutes after being laid off because I didn't know it was happening that day. And I had to borrow my friend's iPad and take that call. And it just kind of felt fitting. It was like, literally one door closed and then I jump on another call. And so that was
so very what did reassuring. Google want you to do?
They wanted me to illustrate a sticker pack. And I was working with an agency in the UK and that was a really and the people I worked with for that agency were just so warm and friendly and so funny.
Was it YCN or like
no, it was Anyways.
Oh yeah, so like the branch, the agency. It's Nice That, right?
Yes,
like it's their sister agency.
I think it is. Yeah, that sounds familiar. I'm not 100% sure, but that sounds really
no,
familiar.
It definitely is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So it's them. And I talked to this really amazing woman who, and I couldn't help but just you know blurt out the fact that like I've had this crazy day and she.
Oh, I just got fired.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, is Google hiring? She was just so nice about it, and we just had a good laugh, and it made me feel really comfortable, and just like okay, I'm just gonna do this now. Like I'm sliding into this next phase and it's gonna be fine. So
you immediately had work, which is great. But do you remember when you left RISD and you like started getting editorial jobs, I imagine you were promoting yourself.
Yes, I was promoting myself like crazy, as much as I can afford, because it is expensive to promote.
So
yourself.
You were sending physical things, right?
Yeah,
you were sending postcards.
Yeah, that kind of
not
day-
email.
I was also sending email and I was even cold calling people, which no one should ever do. But no one told me.
Well, maybe that works. I don't know.
It did not work.
Oh, okay.
No one told me not to do it. And I just found people's phone numbers. Now I just cringe even thinking about
it. It's courageous, though.
It was just a lack of awareness more than anything else. Yeah. I did everything I could, basically, because there was no social media back then, really. I had like a blog.
I mean, even
spot.
Now people have to reach out in some way, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel, you know, I'm I feel very lucky to have to not have had to promote in a while. Although I think that, you know, you still do it in your own way. Like I keep up with my Instagram and that's my work
you do.
Thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I think that that's my way of promoting. And yes, everyone has to do it to some extent. I don't know if people send out mailers anymore. When I was at Etsy, I was getting some, but I don't know.
Like mailers, like you mean like in the mail where you like send, what is it? Like you send like a,
I guess anything.
Like a postcard or,
Yeah, it could be.
No,
like,
people definitely do that.
Okay,
I
mean, cool.
I talked with someone at the New York Times who said they got like, they have a huge drawer of just stuff people send them. Like,
yeah, that's good. I think the Times still likes that. But I mean, in terms of like, if
it's
you want
expensive, definitely to send like physical things to.
Especially if you want to send something that makes you stand out, like something a bit more special, like a pin or a zine, you know, all of that stuff adds up. Like in the beginning, I was sending out hundreds and hundreds of postcards and I couldn't afford. You can like buy those client lists. I think right now the only one is Agency Access, but, but I was basically doing the
but you really don't have to.
You I don't mean, have to. No, absolutely not. Which is why I was trying to get around it by just doing the 3-day trial and then writing down as many names as I could and sending to those people and never actually doing the service.
I've never even done that. Yeah.
Yeah. But again, this was before social media. Like, how do you even find people's information?
Yeah. That's true. Because now you can see people posting and art directors so-and-so and then you can Google it and
Right.
It's way easier. Yeah.
I know. Now you can find, I mean, you can find all of every art director is on Instagram. So you can find their profiles. You can reach out to them if you wanted to. It's a lot easier in that way for like immediate, instant direct communication, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. So there was still like contactless stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, the advice from my teachers was to like go to a Barnes and Noble or a bookstore to look through the back of a magazine and then find the art director's name through that magazine, write it down, then go and research there. It was a lot of work. So yeah, that was a different time.
Yeah. So your strategy with that was just sending as many postcards as you could. And
because because from what I had, my impression was that for every like 100 postcards you send out, maybe 5 to 10 people will get back to you.
Yeah.
So just trying
to get a lot of responses or?
I got some, but I would say that it took a really long time for a lot of those efforts to start to pay off. I think that it's very rare that you put your work in front of an art director at exactly the right time, you know?
Yeah. And they say like, yes, I have something for
you. Yeah, actually
now.
I have a job for you right here. No, it usually is like they hold on to your work. And then you have to like remind them that you exist for another couple of years or so. And then maybe they'll have a job for you sometime down the line.
So you followed up, with people.
I did.
Definitely.
Yes. Yeah. More, I definitely was more persistent with people who I knew I definitely wanted to work for, like the New York Times and the New Yorker. Mm. So there are people that I knew that I would eventually be a good fit for them. I also could recognize that my work wasn't ready at that time. And it was like no hard feelings. I think I was really trying to focus on not taking these rejections or silences as a personal offense. I think that's something that you also have to really you have to like build a thick skin in the beginning because you're just going to get rejected a lot. But that's how it goes.
Since you mentioned the portfolio, like what do you think is a good, really like a good portfolio in terms for illustrators? Like for you, was it really like quantity, or you said you had a lot of different projects when you felt really good about your portfolio after Etsy?
I see. Yeah. That's a really good question.
I don't know, like, because it really depends what work you want to get to, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I've never thought about that. I guess when I taught, I would tell my students to pare down their work.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, as in like not as much, but just focus on the quality?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like you don't have to show everything. So I think that is true for me and for anyone as well. Yeah. I don't think you have to limit yourself in terms of style. I think that I don't think you have to have for me, I've just naturally arrived at a very, specific drawing style.
But it takes time to do that too.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that this approach doesn't work for everyone. You know, I have friends who like to work in all kinds of mediums and different ways of drawing. And I think that's all great because the expression of your personality isn't purely through one style or one medium. So I think that whatever your portfolio the most impactful portfolio is for a person to be able to like see what you're about right away.
Yeah, but it's so hard because a lot of the advice I think that's given is about make sure you're really cohesive and people know what they're going to get.
I think that's a dangerous word.
Yeah,
because I think it can often force, especially younger illustrators, it can often force, make them feel pressure to force a style. And I don't think that's good for
anyone. I've definitely felt that way. Yeah,
I felt that way as well. I think that...
And it feels bad. I mean, it feels uncomfortable when you're forcing a style upon yourself. You do feel it.
Mm-hmm. You always know if you're not happy with what you're doing and if you're not happy with the process. And
do you think that maybe you have to go through those to like kind of figure out your style? I don't know.
I think you could. And also, I do think that it depends on what kind of projects you are trying to pursue, because if you do want those very corporate, very commercial projects, then
they look for different stuff.
Then I guess I would never say that you should change your style or change your work to cater to a client, but could, but maybe it's more about streamlining the content that's in your portfolio. Like you want to show that you can illustrate these topics that like a lot of tech or commercial clients tend to use or tend to illustrate.
The
whole topic of a cohesive style, I mean, I have faith that if you just need to start with doing something that makes you feel happy and something that feels true to you and the way that you express your thoughts, and then if you just stick with that, over time, you're bound to arrive at something that feels right.
Yeah. Did you beef up your portfolio with personal projects? I mean, I feel like you didn't really need to.
I wanted to more, actually. I think that this is where I'm at right now, where I would love to add more personal projects to my mostly commercial portfolio. I think that's just as important.
Like what kind of projects though? Because you've done a lot of different things too.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that right now I'm sort of at a place where I'm sort of picking and choosing my commercial projects and waiting for certain projects to come along that might be more in line with what I would make for myself or what I would make for fun. The next step, I guess, would be to actually dedicate time to make something that isn't client driven.
What do you make for fun?
I don't make anything for fun. I like to bake. I'm kind of intimidated by that, to be honest. I haven't really been making time. I've actually taken a lot of time off this month, which is the first time I've done something like that in a while, because I was just feeling a little bit burnt out and I wanted to have some time where I didn't have to focus so much on work and make work my number one priority.
Yeah.
But I found that in that time, I'm still not really making much work for myself. Like I'm sketchbooking once in a while, but it's been tough to find the motivation to start a project. So it really
doesn't look like that. If you looked at your social media and stuff, I would be like, yeah, Jing just has so many ideas. She's just like bursting.
Social media
with them.
Is a lie.
Yeah. But definitely like even just like you post sometimes pictures of your sketchbooks and I guess they're for assignments that you're doing these sketches, but it looks like, oh my God, she has so many ideas.
Oh,
like,
thank you.
Yeah.
Good. But, I'm glad I'm keeping up the facade.
Yeah. It is kind of like you have to do it in some way.
I mean, I think that, good. I'm glad that's how it appears. I think that day to day, I would definitely love to do more of that. The sketchbooking and drawing casually for fun.
And do you have an idea of certain like applications you'd like to do? Like if you'd like to like paint your stuff or do different mediums or I don't know.
I'm intimidated by paint as well. However, I don't think that I am intimidated by new mediums, I think, or new programs. So I actually originally, when I first graduated from college, I was doing almost all of my work as woodcut prints, which is utterly insane.
I know. Yeah. That's so weird. Yeah.
I don't know.
And that's like, it would have been really hard to do editorial work too, because the turnaround is so small.
Yeah. I was definitely not putting my health first, to be completely honest, in those years, because as I mentioned, a job would come in and, you know, regardless of how fast the deadline was, I would bend over backwards to complete that project because I just wanted to get it done and in hopes of, you know, having that lead to the next one. But the problem with having such a labor intensive process is that it required me staying up all night, multiple nights, and also, you know, not having proper ventilation in my small Brooklyn apartment. So all of that had to change, you know. It definitely helped when I got a dedicated studio, but then I also started to learn Photoshop, you know, and Illustrator. And I have now completely gone digital, and I guess I am missing some of those more tactile mediums. I think that I do collages, I think, as a way to counterbalance that, but I think painting is something that I've just never been really familiar with. But I am really interested in learning, like I taught myself After Effects somewhat recently, and I'm really interested in, in just kind of diving into to tools that can change my work or change, I don't know, the way that my work, the way that people can view and interact with my work.
Yeah. And you have a class on Skillshare.
I do.
Which is really cool. And I was really happy to see that because, I mean, Skillshare is growing, but there's not a lot of illustrators on it, actually, I think. I mean, there's a few.
Yeah, there are a few. I think that it's a tough thing to teach. Like, you have to break down, you almost have to break it down to like each individual aspect. You know, like you can have a class about color, or you can have a class about concepting, but to put it all together is a bit tough because it's also different for everyone. Like, it's so personal.
Yeah. And it looked like in the class you use an iPad now to sketch, which is kind of cool to see.
Yeah, that was another thing that I picked up a couple of years ago. And that was, I really didn't think that I would embrace it so much, but I love my iPad. Like, it's so, it's just a really efficient process.
Yeah, all the illustrators I talk to almost just have switched to an iPad now. And like, it's kind of crazy.
I know, it is crazy that I'm using a completely different set of tools now to make an image as I did when I first got out. So,
but do you still use Illustrator and Photoshop and all that stuff? Or
yeah, I learned Illustrator when I was at Etsy because I kind of had to learn Illustrator because I had to make scalable work essentially.
Right. Yeah.
So I remember it's a completely different. It's not very intuitive, so it was pretty much
like, I like it too.
Yeah. But I think in the beginning, like, I see a lot of people being very frustrated with it, and I was definitely frustrated with it.
Well, it's definitely not like drawing or anything. It's so different.
Yeah. It's like math. it's the complete opposite.
I don't know if it's like math or it's more like, I don't know, like, it feels to me like you can build stuff in a way, like it, and you can, I don't know.
Yeah.
Mold stuff, like with the anchors and the, I don't know.
That's true. You're almost like sculpting these shapes until it looks like what you want it to look like.
I like it because I'm not that good of a drawer.
Oh.
Like, I don't know. Sometimes it feels like it's the more perfect, I don't know. It's easy to make a shape that's perfect in Illustrator.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. That's funny because I often have to try to make shapes less perfect in Illustrator because the default is like,
well,
so
ultimately
clean.
After that, I started to feel like that too, because you go too far and then it,
Right.
Yeah. But there's something reassuring about adjusting a curve. I don't know. It feels really nice to me.
Yeah, no, it's very soothing. I mean, now it's like second nature. I use it primarily even over Photoshop. So it's definitely my number one program at this point.
And it's kind of strange because actually looking at your work, you can't really tell that it's vector. I mean,
oh, cool.
It kind of looks a little bit like, I don't know, I kind of thought you were doing mostly Photoshop until I saw your class, because it really doesn't look too vectory, or, you know, I don't mean that as an insult, but just like,
no, I see that as a compliment, actually.
Great. But even I was not trying to insult people who do just vector illustration, because I think there's some people doing really good vector illustration, but
yeah, absolutely.
But sometimes it feels a little bit cold to me.
Yeah, I know. And I think that that's something I try to pay attention to as well. I think I can see that my characters have gotten like a bit more soft and warm, almost as a way to offset the coldness of the inherent coldness of the program. So maybe that's what you're picking up on. But
yeah, and you do add texture and stuff and the and so it does not feel as cold and flat, I think.
Yeah, thanks. That's good to know.
Yeah. So I just I mean, we're almost running out of time, but I also wanted to know more like about your process. I know you do a lot of sketching. Like, it seems like for like to come up with an idea, you really go through these like tiny thumbnail sketches that seem really well organized. I saw one of your sketchbook one time and I was like, wow, this looks organized and great. Yeah. But is that usually how you work? Like, you just iterate a lot of visual concepts like that? Or
I think that I definitely really like to be organized in my work, because I think it's so easy to I don't know, to be all over the place. So I need to set some guidelines for myself. So I kind of separate my process out into different phases. I actually also think that this is something that came from my printmaking days, because you have to be really organized when you set up your boards and your prints. And
you mean in RISD?
At RISD, yeah. I and after RISD as well, because just working with printmaking in general, like, you, it's such a process oriented task that if you don't set up your drawing and separate your colors properly, then it's just like gets worse and worse and more complicated as you go down the line. So I think that's something that's always stayed with me. So I'll even like break down my day based on which process I want to tackle. So for example, I could like, you know, do tiny little thumbnails on the train, like on my phone even, or just very, very quick composition and concept sketches that don't even really look like anything to anyone but me. And then maybe I'll like get to the studio and then I'll flesh out those drawings into more concrete sketches that I can present, and then after that I'll bring it into the computer.
Do you ever struggle with like finding a good idea for
Time earlier today, like right before I got on a call with you, I thought this was gonna be a good break. I'm working on something right now that, and sketches are due tomorrow, and I'm just like stuck at a roadblock.
Do you usually take a break, or
Yes. So this is my break.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. It's been nice chatting with you. I think taking a break is always good for me. It took me a while to realize that that was a good thing, because I think in the past, I've definitely tried to just stick it out and just like stare so hard at this blank piece of paper, or just draw these boxes over and over again that, you know, amount to nothing. But I think that stepping away and coming at this prompt, like rereading the prompt from a fresh perspective is always better.
Yeah. And do you have kind of a standard of what makes a good idea for an editorial illustration? Because I know there's a lot of different approaches. There's some people that are more conceptual, and I think I would put you in that probably.
Thanks.
But like, there are people who are more narrative and just descriptive, their drawings. And
yeah, that's true.
There's definitely different approaches to it. And there's people that really combine different concepts in interesting ways. And like, I don't know, do you think a lot about that? Or
Definitely. I think that I try to focus on the mood and tone. And I think that a good concept definitely has to capture that aspect of the article first and foremost. And then it has to be a quick read in terms of the general idea. And I think that the best concepts it's a quick read, but it's not a one-liner, you know, like you can kind of sit with it for a bit, and there's something in the image that makes you want to stay with it and to keep looking at it and explore the composition. And there has to kind of be layers to it. And so it's kind of tough to verbalize, you know, because a lot of it is based on feeling. And it's kind of interesting that I think that my work used to be a lot more concept heavy when I was first starting out. And I really enjoyed that aspect of making an illustration. But now I think because I have been working on a lot of projects that sort of involve surface design and where the concept is almost secondary, fear. And I think that it is true that some of that work is also funneling into my editorial work. So I almost have to, like, you know, sort of remember to recalibrate a little bit when I get an editorial piece. I'm not just like,
I mean, there's a definite skill to that type of work as well, because it has to be, and it's more commercial.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't know. it's not as concept heavy, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. It sort of has to be bold. Depending on what.
And you're really good at making these kind of like busy scenes. Mm-hmm. That, like, I think those are really hard to do as well. That do really well for commercial work, really. Like,
Clients love a busy scene. They can't get enough of it.
yeah. Is that mostly what you get asked to do? Or?
I think that's actually, it's always sort of a safe, appealing direction.
Yeah.
I don't mind doing it. I haven't gotten sick of it yet. I think that there are a lot of ways to interpret that, you know, that approach. And I want to be able to do it all, you know. I want to be able to do a very simple, very clean concept, and I also want to do something that's a little bit more moody, like the sci-fi stuff that I do for the Times, and I want to do but then I also want to do something that's just like really lovely, like a crowd scene or just like a really colorful, dense scene, you know.
Yeah, I can see that. What was one of your favorite projects that you worked on recently?
What have I worked on recently? I painted a mural for Shake Shack that I really enjoyed because it was,
I saw that. Yeah.
Again, so physically grueling that I felt I could only feel joy coming out of that because the days were so tough and long. But I weirdly love those kinds of projects where I'm not quite sure how it's going to turn out. And then it surprises myself a little bit. And I just feel very satisfied from overcoming those kinds of hurdles. And I also always love the sci-fi column. Like, I'm always excited to get that email from Matt Dorfman.
Yeah. How often do you do that?
It's been less and less. I think in the beginning it was maybe about a month and a half. Now it's probably once every 2 months.
Okay.
So it's very, it's not very frequent at all.
But still
steady.
Semi-regular. Yeah.
It's good because I feel like I can just, it's a very specific assignment. So I think that I always like tap into that mode. I always tap into the sci-fi mode, and no other projects that I've gotten have really been the same, in the same vein.
Yeah. And Matt Dorfman is like such a,
he's amazing.
Kind of a legendary kind of art director, I guess. Like, I don't know.
He is deserving of that title. Yeah. He's very, very good. One of my favorite art directors of all time.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Just That's very great. Smart, very funny, and just always gets it, you know, like always points you in the right direction.
Yeah. And I know your work is really popular in the US, but I wonder, is it popular in China?
Or do that's a great question. It is not. Not at all.
Is that because you just haven't tried to introduce it there? Or?
I don't even know how I would go about doing that because I do speak Chinese. I am fluent, but I am not very eloquent in Chinese, and I cannot read or write either. So I guess I am very much.
But they could still use your illustrations. I mean,
that is true.
You know, you don't have to speak Korean to do something in Seoul or something.
Yeah,
like
that's a very good point.
A lot of people do that. So
that's true. I guess
I also don't know if the market is really about like commercial wise if they brand stuff with illustration there, and I don't know.
I definitely see a few big China projects coming from my friends' feeds. I would say that they are not, it doesn't seem like there are a lot of jobs coming frequently out of that market. But again, I'm so not tapped into that side of the world that I have no idea if they are just hiring a lot of illustrators and we're just not getting those jobs or, But I mean, I think in my experience visiting both China and Japan, it seems like illustration as a career is less of a, especially freelance illustration, it's a bit less of a thing as it is here. And in a place like London, for example.
You think even in Japan?
Yeah, I was recently there and I was talking to a couple of friends who live there, and their impression is that freelance illustration just doesn't really, it doesn't exist in the same capacity because the jobs are so low paying.
Because I know there's a lot of people working in like animation.
Yes.
Like doing set, like background illustration and stuff like that.
Yeah. So it'll probably be more of a steady job like that. Or maybe there are
But those
of,
are not very high paying either, I don't think.
I actually don't know if they are, but I would have guessed maybe not. Or maybe you could be a manga artist. Manga is huge, obviously, in Japan.
Yeah, yeah, so, but it's not, it's different.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's very different. That's like being an author, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in China, I visited a school a couple of years ago, and I think that my impression from the students was that everyone was sort of like they were looking to someone to tell them what to do versus, and they didn't really know how to begin exploring like individual expression because they were just wanting to follow the rules, you know, and wanting to go through their education in this way. So I thought that was interesting. And I'm sure that that kind of mentality has an effect on, you know, even the possibility of existing as a freelance illustrator where all you do is sort of exude your own personal brand and style.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it must feel weird for you, like that the US was once this like alien place and, you know, you felt kind of weird coming here. Mm-hmm. And now it's just like, your work is so popular here and you're kind of a voice in cultural voice, you know? It must feel kind of strange. I don't know.
That is incredibly strange because I have not thought about that until you said that just now. So, yeah, that is crazy. I mean, I definitely consider myself a Chinese American because I've spent the majority of my life here, but obviously my roots are in China. And I do think about how different my life would have been if I stayed in China and if I grew up there. I don't think I would have been an illustrator. I probably wouldn't have pursued art or drawing at all. So I probably
I don't know much about the education system, but art schools are not really, are they really a thing there? I don't know.
There are a few, a couple that I can think of, very famous art schools, including that one that I visited. And people either come out of there and teach, or I think they move here, you know, and either go to grad school or try to start a career here. So yeah, I probably would not have, I probably would have just gotten a very practical degree if I had stayed.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Do your parents like your work, you think?
Yeah, they do. I hope they do. I never asked them.
but they seem to relate to it, or?
I don't think they can relate to it. I think that they do have an eye for it at this point, which I'm very happy about. Like they can recognize when something is my work versus when it's someone else's.
Because I think because they couldn't in the beginning, you think?
I don't know that they couldn't. Maybe I just haven't given them enough credit. Okay. But recently, you know, they've been like, oh, I saw this thing and I think it's you or this thing looks like you. And it's good that they're paying attention to that.
Have you ever had them describe what your style is?
Like, no.
Tell me what you think my style is.
Wow, that's a really great question. I'm gonna put them on the spot next time.
Yeah, because whenever my mother tries to describe what I'm doing, I feel like she gets it. I just feel like that's not at all what I want.
How does she describe it?
I don't know, but in the very beginning I remember just feeling like, oh my god, that's just not what I want to do. Like I don't know. Like I think she told me that I could maybe illustrate you know, like pictograms of people, like, you know, like people like a toilet sign almost.
And
I found that offensive. I mean, again, I don't think she can relate to the idea that illustration really is a thing, and I haven't proven that to her enough. So she's just thinking of things that I could do. And maybe illustrate toilet signs or something. I don't know.
I think that I didn't even know how to really, for a long time, I think that I just didn't talk about the work that I was doing. And I would only send them my work if it was something that was related to China. Yeah, so I think that's how I started, was years ago. That's how I sort of started introducing.
So you didn't even send them when you got your jobs, like the first few jobs? You didn't even say, hey,
no,
I got this?
No, I said it, but I didn't show them, I guess.
Oh,
that's
okay.
So, yeah, that's really unfortunate now that I think about it. It sort of backfired because most of the time when I illustrate something for the New York Times and it's about China, it's not good. So so they would read it and be like, ooh, I don't think you should be illustrating for this company. You know, that would be its own thing, but now I'm better about sharing. But I've never asked them to describe that. I feel like that would be really cruel for them to to try to go through that while with me watching.
It'd be interesting to see. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely would be interesting, especially when like when we take a family trip or something. And I think that would be the perfect opportunity for them to try to describe what their child does to their, to their family members.
Yeah, or you could watch them like introduce you or something. I wonder how they introduce you.
Yeah, good tip. Yeah. I'll try that next time.
I don't know. It might create some myself. Tensions. I don't know. It might not be a good idea. I'm quite confrontational. Like, I try to get my parents to tell me what they think all the time.
Oh, I'm starting to do that now. Yeah, years of therapy has definitely made me a lot more confrontational within my own family.
Yeah, no, I've always been like that. So it's like, yeah, I just do it.
It's good.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it creates problems. Like, I'm known to be a troublemaker in this way.
I mean, if you're just being honest.
Yeah, yeah, but they don't always like it.
That's fair.
Yeah. So to end all, like, I just wanted to ask you a few quick questions, like really rapid things that are like super easy to answer if you have time.
Sure, yeah.
So like, what's your favorite New York thing to do?
Oh man, I'm so bad at these super easy questions. No, but it's good. I need to think about this. What's my favorite New York thing to do?
Yeah,
definitely eat. Nothing makes me happier.
Much good food.
So much good food. Yeah.
What's your favorite place to eat then in New York?
Ooh,
do you have one or a couple? Or?
There are so many different places because New York is enormous. I always love going to K-Town. I will always enjoy a K-barbecue meal followed by karaoke. That's probably my one of my favorite kinds of nights out. So yeah, let's say that.
Yeah. Okay. What are your main sources of inspiration, even if they're not directly illustrators? You know,
I have been thinking about this recently because I never have a good answer for this because I feel like
it's kind of a hard question.
Yeah, just trying to answer it automatically. Like whenever I start to answer this question, I find myself saying cheesy things that aren't even true. Like I like to travel, and I mean, not obviously, I do get inspiration.
But is there something that you do when you do it? You kind of unlock new ideas, or you get really inspired to draw, or I don't know.
I need a lot of alone time. I don't know if it's because I'm an only child, but I love alone time. And I think a lot of my inspiration and motivation comes from me having had that time, that like reset time. And a lot of the times I'm just like walking around by myself and just sort of
So you do alone time, but where you are outside still, like
I have these little routines that I have.
I have to shelter myself though. Like I don't know.
Oh,
I don't
how so?
Count walking outside as alone time.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I'm too like tuned in to what people think of me, and I don't enjoy it as much.
Oh, interesting. I guess I am also very tuned into if people are looking at me or if I'm, but I think after a lot of years in New York, you sort of also learn to feel alone while you're out amongst people, you know?
That's true. Actually, I think when I lived in New York for a summer, I did walk alone a lot and it didn't feel as like people were looking at me or anything.
I think that you do always run the risk when you're like exposed of somebody yelling at you or running into some sort of jarring experience. But for the most part, I find that I can have some good quality time just absorbing like quiet things around me.
Yeah. What's a book that you've recently read that you would recommend?
I am reading The Argonauts right now.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
I definitely would recommend that. I'm about halfway through, and it's pretty great. I also would recommend Goodbye Vitamin by Rachel Cohn.
Oh, I've not heard of that. Yeah.
It's also quite good. She and I used to work together at Lucky Peach, and then she wrote a book, which is amazing. It is not food related, but it's very much like diving into a family. And
that's great.
And sickness and trying to navigate that.
Cool. And do you listen to podcasts? And if so, do you have any favorite ones?
I do listen to podcasts. I really like movies. I will listen. This is so strange because I usually take podcast recommendations from friends and reputable sources, but I've been listening to this podcast that I just Googled completely randomly because I wanted to see if anybody had reviewed this specific movie that I wanted to look up. And then I came across this podcast called Straight Chilling. And it's just
I don't know that one.
And it's just a bunch of dudes in Florida, like reviewing horror movies.
It's just men.
I think they're very aware. So they do bring on female guests as well, especially when it's a movie that requires a female perspective. So they're definitely aware that they can't just be a bunch of sweaty dudes in a room. What else do I listen to? I listen to the suite of NPR podcasts. You know, I like Invisibilia. I'll listen to The Daily. Yeah, classics.
The Daily is so good.
Yes, definitely. I also used to listen to, not so much anymore, but My Brother and Me. I think that's what it's called, actually. It's been a little while.
I don't know that.
But those, it's like a set of brothers who have a bunch of podcasts. They also had a D&D podcast that I was listening to for a while. That was really fun. And lastly, I also listened to a Bachelor recap podcast.
Oh my God, no, me too.
Yes.
No, wait, which that's one? Embarrassing.
I know, but you know what? We've been talking for an hour and a half now. So, and we're getting there.
I mean, so I'm not proud of this, but
no one is proud of this information.
Yeah. My wife, like, we started watching The Bachelor and The Bachelorette because being French, like, I'd not grown up watching this. So I didn't understand it completely. Like, I didn't understand the full extent of it. And my wife was kind of just like, oh, you've never seen this. Like, and I was like, no, I mean, I know what it is. Like he picks a woman. It's like reality TV.
Right.
She's like, no, but you need to watch it. Like, it's really, really weird. Like, it's something about America you need to understand. Like,
right.
And we've been watching it since then. And then she mentioned this podcast and I did enjoy it. And I don't remember. It's like called like, it's by HuffPost, I think.
Oh yeah,
the one I listened to.
I have listened to that one. It's called. Is it called Here to Make Friends? Yes, they're so snarky. I like those. Yeah, I like those hosts a lot.
Yeah, I do like that because I don't think I can take it too seriously. The whole show.
It's it's kind of it's really strange because you can really get into it, but you're always like, you always feel like you're above it a little bit. You know?
Yeah,
but
it's
at the same time,
a thing where you're like insulting people as. Yeah.
Right. But then over time, you kind of find that part of you is actually genuinely into it. And that's what's disturbing about it.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're starting to say, I like him. He's genuine. And
I know. But the bar for people is so low for that show that you just kind of like, it's not even, you tap into a different mindset completely.
What's the one you listen to then?
Bachelor Party.
Oh, okay. Yeah. My wife had told me about that one too.
Yeah,
I think she listens to two Bachelor podcasts and she's really embarrassed.
I'm trying to avoid admitting that myself because I definitely know both of those.
She feels really bad. Yeah,
it's okay. I tell her that she has a friend in me.
Yeah. All right. So I think this is a good place to end it.
Cool.
Thanks so much for being on. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, great talking to you too.
And that was my conversation with Jing Wei. That's it from me this week. And as always, please check out the comprehensive show notes of this episode. It's at illustrationhour.com/Wei, W-E-I. I hope you have a creative and very good week ahead.